This is The Takeaway for Monday, October 30th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you for being with us today as we spend our day digesting the news that Robert Mueller and his special counsel investigation has filed charges against former campaign officials working for President Donald Trump. President Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, has turned himself in to the FBI today. Manafort and his former business associate, Rick Gates, have been charged each 12 counts, mostly financial-related charges, ranging from conspiracy against the United States to acting as an unregistered foreign agent and more. The charges come 5 months into special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into possible connections between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. But it was also revealed today that George Papadopoulos, one of President Trump's more junior foreign policy advisors early on in the campaign, pled guilty to lying to the FBI about a contact with a Russian professor with ties to the Kremlin earlier this month. After Manafort surrendered himself to the authorities, the president took to Twitter. He said, "Sorry, but this is years ago, before Manafort was part of the Trump campaign. But why aren't crooked Hillary and the Dems the focus?" Also, the president said, "There is no collusion." We want to get some analysis now from an expert into charges like this and what this could mean for the ongoing investigation from Robert Mueller. Jennifer Rogers is executive director of the Center for Advancement of Public Integrity from Columbia Law School and a former federal prosecutor herself. Jennifer, thanks for joining us again here on The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Jennifer, you have prosecuted money laundering cases and foreign agent cases similar to what appear to be in the charges here. A conspiracy against the U.S., conspiracy to launder money, acting as an unregistered foreign agent, making false statements. So help us out here, Jennifer. When you look at the scope of the charges here against Paul Manafort and, of course, Rick Gates, what do you see?
Well, I see a long-standing scheme to make a bunch of money under the table, much of it, bring it into the U.S. and spend it without paying taxes on it, of course, without letting the U.S. know about either the work that they were doing or the money that they were making. And of course, you know, not registering as a foreign agent for the work that they were doing here in the U.S. as well on behalf of Russia, friendly Ukrainian groups.
So most of these charges are financial related. The president makes the point, which appears to be true, this all happened well before the Trump campaign even existed. So the allegations of lawbreaking here are not the same thing as the political ramifications or the fallout.
Well, it's certainly true that factually this is a different set of facts than the Trump campaign colluding with Russians to interfere in the election. It's not entirely true that it's all ancient history. The charges go up through 2016. So it's not that it was so long ago. It's just that factually it's separate from collusion with the Russians in connection with the investigation.
So does this give us any sense from the prosecutor's point of view where Mueller's investigation is at or where it may be headed?
Well, it's interesting. I think, you know, before the more recent charges came out against Papadopoulos, I would say, you know, he's focused on Manafort and Gates as more potential cooperators. I mean, these are very hefty charges. These are serious charges. They carry a lot of time. So even though they're not directly related to the collusion case, it puts a lot of pressure on Manafort and on Gates to cooperate and tell what they know about the Russian interference. Now that we also have the Papadopoulos charges, now we're looking more at kind of direct charges against someone who was involved in ties between the campaign and the Russians.
So what are prosecutors likely doing here? You mentioned putting pressure on Paul Manafort, Rick Gates, and others to tell what they know. Is it likely that Mueller wants Paul Manafort and Gates in jail or wants to use them to get to other people?
I think the latter. You know, if this is as far as the charges go, then they'll be, you know, presumably convicted if the evidence is strong enough and sentenced. But what he really wants is to learn everything there is to learn. And that involves flipping people who know things. And this is how you do it. You bring leverage against them by bringing hefty charges. And then if it's in their best interest to cooperate, which I think it is, given the scope of these charges, then when they come in and tell all they know, then that may lead to charges against other people.
It's been said in the press and by many analysts, prosecutors like you, Jennifer, that special counsels and the FBI don't go after individuals. They go after operations, schemes, or institutions.
It depends. I mean, they go after individuals, too, certainly, depending on the conduct. It's also true, though, that we know that these allegations against Manafort and this investigation by the FBI had been ongoing for some time and had laid dormant for some time. So I think that kind of goes to your point. They kind of knew about some of this. They had investigated some of this. It didn't really, you know, it wasn't really in their interest to pursue it vigorously and bring it to a conclusion until now, when they think that Manafort knows a lot about this other investigation that they're pursuing. So now is the time they bring these charges against Manafort and Gates. We'll see if they're willing to come in. We'll see what they know, and then they'll pursue whatever comes of that.
Of course, the fact that these charges and these men are in the orbit of the President of the United States has political ramifications, certainly, but also potential legal ones, Jennifer. How does somebody like Paul Manafort try to gauge whether he might be ripe for a pardon from the president? I mean, if prosecutors are leaning on him to tell what he knows in exchange for lenient treatment, he might not want to play that card and say, well, I have a pardon in my future, so I don't have to tell you anything.
That's a very interesting question. It's something that basically has never come up before. I mean, we've never had a scenario in which the president essentially is being investigated and there's this threat kind of overriding everything that he may just start preemptively pardoning people and thwarting the investigation that way. I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, I've read a legal analysis that he can do that. He can preemptively pardon people. Then, you know, you might see some state attorneys general picking up with it and seeing if there are charges that they can bring. You know, certainly there were crimes committed here that might be state crimes in addition to federal crimes. So, you know, we're kind of in uncharted territory. We'll have to see what happens here. I still think what's hanging over Manafort's head is really, really serious charges with a lot of jail time attached. So, you know, and we of course know the president has been distancing himself from Manafort as well. So relying on that potential pardon is pretty risky for Manafort right now. So we'll just have to see what he decides to do.
And let's talk about George Papadopoulos, who was a relatively low-level foreign policy aide to President Trump in the campaign. Papadopoulos has acknowledged, pled guilty to lying to the FBI, and the substance of that lie appears to be having met with a Russian professor with ties to the Kremlin who was offering dirt on Hillary Clinton during the campaign. How important is that fact from the prosecutor's point of view?
I think it's kind of medium important. You know, it depends on what else he knows, of course. He's obviously cooperating with authorities. So, you know, presumably there are things that he knows that do not appear in the public documents. The other thing is, of course, as a political matter, the Trump campaign and Trump has said all along, oh, we didn't seek dirt. You know, we didn't meet with any Russians. We were not trying to do that. And this, of course, exposes that, you know, that actually wasn't true, that at least some elements of the campaign were actively trying to meet with Russians and trying to get that dirt. So, you know, we know some things, but it doesn't appear to be a blockbuster unless Papadopoulos knows a lot. And given his level, it doesn't seem likely to me that he would know as much as a higher level official would, like a Manafort.
And those higher level officials, Paul Manafort and possibly others, may come into this story before it's over, Jennifer. Can you talk a little bit about what it might be like for Robert Mueller and his team to prosecute a case like this that is so imbued with politics? I mean, this is not like prosecuting some local racketeer and throwing him in jail or getting him to flip. There are undeniable political ramifications, national political ramifications. It's a scandal, not to mention the president's power to pardon under the Constitution. This is not your average prosecution.
That is certainly true. I think it's a great deal of pressure. I think they're probably just trying to keep their heads down and do the investigative work and do the prosecution work and not get caught up in all of those ramifications. But, you know, you can't even walk down the street or you know, turn on the news without hearing about it. So it does bring a lot of pressure to them. I just hope they can kind of continue to work and be productive, notwithstanding that pressure. And of course, it goes without saying that all of the decisions and judgments they make should be made without any kind of political thoughts whatsoever, which of course is why Mueller was chosen in the first place, given his reputation and his history.
And the politics are for everyone else, and certainly will be. I can guarantee that before it's over. Jennifer, what about the possible broad scope of charges here? And I know you can't speculate on who else might be charged because we just don't know that. But in terms of how big investigations like this work, is it likely that Robert Mueller and his team got charges together on three people and rolled them out right away? Or that this is part of a strategy that's a rolling series of indictments that could touch other people who were subject to the investigation? What's the strategy here?
Well, you know, I don't know exactly what they're doing. The charges against Manafort and Gates seem to be fairly cabined to them. I don't know that there are other people in the Trump orbit who had anything factually to do with these allegations. I think the Papadopoulos charges are more interesting because you're talking about other campaign officials who were involved in that, so we might see some more charges there. We have Michael Flynn sitting out there, of course, with fairly straightforward charges likely available on him. I think they're just trying to say, listen, we're serious, we're productive, we are working. They put these people out there, three of them, one of whom is already cooperating, two of whom they certainly would like to speak to. And it's just kind of ratcheting up the pressure on everyone involved in this. If they're not speaking to law enforcement already, they should be. That's kind of part of the message they're trying to say, that we're working, we're doing it, come in and talk to us, we got to get this thing going.
Jennifer, so much of the focus in this investigation, of course, has been on collusion with the Russians in the campaign. It's the sexiest part of this entire investigation, but it's really only one narrow piece of the possibilities here. We've pointed that out on the show. And also that many aspects of what we think of as possible collusion aren't really illegal, just troubling ethically, certainly politically in this country. Can you put that in context of what we already know about the charges against Manafort and how this case plays out in the political sphere? Because it will.
Well, so you kind of hit the nail on the head. You kind of have the legal side and then the political side, which isn't necessarily illegal. So what Manafort and Gates were doing with all of this money and their failure to register is illegal activity. And certainly there is potential illegal activity in the collusion piece as well, if there were, you know, hacking, that sort of thing going on. But then there's this whole other political side. I mean, the collecting of Oppo research, that sort of thing, which isn't illegal, but probably, but is ethically questionable. So, you know, lawyers can only charge what is against the law. So that's, of course, what Mueller and his team are doing. But they've also charged, pursuant to the statute that established his office, to write a report on this investigation. So the report will contain information that doesn't all necessarily go to actual illegal activity, but provides, hopefully, a complete narrative, or as complete as it can be, of the facts of what happened here and what they learned in their investigation, which should kind of contain both pieces of the puzzle, at least as far as they can establish them. So, you know, there's interplay there, but at the end of the day, the prosecutors can't and won't charge anything that isn't technically illegal, and so that's what they're looking to tease out where they can find it.
The president have reason to worry?
Of course, every day, and we're seeing it on Twitter.
Jennifer Rogers, Columbia Law School and former federal prosecutor.
Thank you.
Thanks for staying with us here on The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Let's stay with the indictments from Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation today. The indictment against Paul Manafort, Trump's former campaign manager, and his former business associate, Rick Gates, includes reference to tens of millions of dollars the two men allegedly received as unregistered foreign agents for Ukraine that they then funneled through offshore accounts in Cyprus, which they then allegedly used to buy property around New York City. Well, back in March, WNYC published an investigation into Paul Manafort's real estate dealings in New York. Here to help us explain how it's all connected is Andrea Bernstein, senior editor for WNYC. Andrea, great to have you.
Hey, great to be back.
Well, you've spent a lot of time investigating some of the real estate deals in New York that seem to be connected to at least some of the charges against Paul Manafort and Rick Gates today. Explain what you know.
So let me just go back to March and describe these properties. One of them is a brownstone, a townhouse in a low-rise area of Brooklyn. Not fancy. We're not talking about a Manhattan skyscraper. And we noticed that Manafort had taken a almost $7 million loan on that house. It followed a pattern where he had bought homes using shell companies, then many years later transferred them from the shell company into his name and took out a loan. They were also purchased initially with all cash, without a loan. So we thought, that's weird. What could that mean? Especially because the amounts of money that he was borrowing against these homes was so large. So we began to talk to a number of experts. We spoke to nine in total who said to us, that could be money laundering. And today, that is apparently what the special counsel believes, that in fact, these were central to a scheme to get money from that Paul Manafort and his business partner had been making from the Ukrainian dictator, a Putin ally, that he had been making money from this party called the Party of Regions in the Ukraine, and not declaring it to U.S. government officials, not declaring it as income, instead routing it through bank accounts in Cyprus and then into a Brooklyn brownstone and an apartment in Soho in Lower Manhattan in New York City. And
so that, Andrea, how do you know, though, that how do you know that these are the properties that are the source of the money laundering charges that are in today's indictment?
Well, they're named in the indictment, these very properties and these LLCs, MC Soho and MC Brooklyn was the name of them. There's a third LLC that we looked at, interestingly, called John Hanna LLC, which is the name of a shell company that Manafort used to purchase his apartment in Trump Tower in 2006. The indictment doesn't spell out specifically how that LLC is involved in all of this, but it does talk about the Brooklyn real estate, the Soho real estate. And not only that, apparently in Soho, Manafort was renting it out on Airbnb. And he got a charge for that, too, because he's accused of lying about the fact that it wasn't his primary residence.
So we should point out, because you mentioned something that will be of interest to listeners, that Paul Manafort had also used a shell company, John Hanna LLC, to purchase a property in Trump Tower, but that purchase is not included in any of the charges today.
Right. It's the LLC is named as one of the businesses and companies that Manafort and Gates used to get this money out of the Ukraine and into the U.S. without paying taxes on it. But it's not spelled out how. Interestingly, a little side note here, John Hanna LLC is named after the middle names of Paul Manafort and another business partner, not named today, but his name is Rick Hanna Davis. So that is how the name John Hanna LLC came about. And we spent a month puzzling that over, and we felt like that was interesting because at the time those two men were doing business. It had come out both with the Ukrainians, but also with a Russian oligarch.
Well, Andrea, we've also heard that state officials in the state of New York are investigating. New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman looking into these deals and other aspects of financial dealings of Trump associates in New York City. What's going on in those investigations? How is it different from what you're reporting on today?
Well, it's not clear to us that they are entirely separate. However, the point has been made by some legal analysts that state charges would not be subject to presidential pardon. So that's in the realm of legal theory, which we haven't been looking at. But I think what is so interesting is that these New York properties, which we found just by looking at New York land records and really digging into them, were a central way that Manafort was accused of getting this money into the U.S. to pay for things, including a lavish luxury lifestyle. And the charges are also that he ran money through an Alexandria drug dealer, a contractor in the Hamptons, which is a very Tony Beach resort area out on Long Island, and that he was getting money in this way. And I think it's worth noting that when Manafort began to take money out of these properties as a loan, which was sort of the next piece of it, the money comes in, it sits in the property, and then he starts loaning money. And that's how he sort of, the allegation is, turns dirty money into clean money, because once it's a loan, it comes from a bank and it's good. That money came very close to the tenure of Manafort at the Trump campaign and coincided almost exactly with the period in time of the Trump campaign itself. So I know the president this morning tweeted that this happened long before him, but in fact, Paul Manafort was reaping the benefits of this during the time that Trump was running for president, some of it while Trump was while he was Trump's campaign manager.
Andrea Bernstein at WNYC and the team at our home station, WNYC, has been doing the reporting on some of the property purchases that are behind allegations from Robert Mueller of money laundering by Rick Gates and former campaign manager Paul Manafort. Andrea Bernstein, it's great to have you doing that reporting, and it's great to have you joining us to break it all down.
Thanks so much. Always great to talk to you.
we've been hearing from you on this breaking news all day. What do you make of Mueller's investigation and this first round of charges? Jennifer says on Facebook, "I love our country. Laws prevail." Well, we'll see what the law has to say about these indictments and the charges that are inside them. You can call us anytime at 877-8-MY-TAKE to weigh in. That number again, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or find us on Facebook where you can join the discussion, always. We'll be following this story all day long, so you can also follow me and reach me on Twitter. I'm at Todd Zwillick. Let's return now to our ongoing coverage of Puerto Rico, where a controversial contract to restore power to the island has been canceled by Puerto Rican power company officials. This comes as the island continues to deal with power outages and shortages, and also news that hundreds of deaths ruled to be from natural causes may have been misidentified. Nidhi Prakash is a reporter at BuzzFeed News. Nidhi, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
You've just come back from Puerto Rico. What's the latest?
That's right. So I was there for nearly 3 weeks, Todd. And basically, while I was there on the ground, I kept hearing from people that the official death count is lower than what they thought it should be, that there were more people in this town or that town that they knew of who had died because of the hurricane. So essentially what I did was I went to, you know, went to the source, went to the funeral directors, to the crematorium directors who were receiving these bodies. And what they told me was that they'd received far more, dozens more bodies of people who they said were related to the hurricane, who had died of causes related to the hurricane, than the ones that were being counted in the death count.
And so why designate some of those deaths natural causes and not to other causes?
So I think that the underlying problem here is that there is no clear guidance from the central government about what counts as a hurricane-related death and what doesn't. So that is the kind of communication gap that I definitely encountered there on the ground, is that funeral directors don't actually know that they're supposed to classify things differently or even take action differently if they think that someone has passed away because of the hurricane.
To be clear, citizens around those towns don't think there's some cover-up of the severity of the storm and its aftermath, right? This just seems to be a classification problem?
So to be honest with you, I don't think they know what's going on the kind of central government level, partly because many people are still really disconnected. So there's still something like 2.5 million people who don't have energy and, you know, a lot of people who still don't have cell service. So they're quite disconnected, but all they know is that there are a lot more people that they're seeing in their communities who have died because of the lack of energy in their homes or in the hospitals who aren't showing up on that death count.
And with 900 people cremated, as we said at the top, we may never know the actual cause of death.
Right. I mean, I think that's the thing, is that so far the central government, you know, when I took this story to them, they still see it as a completely separate process. They're not sort of correlating those deaths with possibly what's going on with the hurricane. They're sort of saying these are two completely separate issues, which from talking to funeral directors, they consider many of those deaths to be hurricane related.
Well, Nidhi, while these funeral directors and loved ones reckon with these deaths in Puerto Rico, the island is trying to rebuild. Let's talk about this Whitefish contract to rebuild the electrical grid in Puerto Rico. Got a lot of attention last week, including on this show. A $300 million contract to this small company in Montana, no-bid contract, has now been canceled by authorities. Why canceled?
That's right. So yesterday, the head of PREPA, which is the Puerto Rico Electric Authority, Ricardo Ramos, held a press conference and said that finally the contract will be canceled. That's after pressure for a week from the governor, from congressional investigations that are now underway, from local investigations that are also underway into the contract. And that's because the contract essentially, it didn't follow the kind of procedure that is normally followed after a disaster. So there's normally a process that involves going through the American Public Power Association. That association essentially has members in public utilities across the country. And so after a disaster like Harvey or like Irma, the local governments went through that association to contract public utilities to come in and help restore the grid. That is not what the Puerto Rican government did. They went to this private company, which was, you know, a little known company in Montana that it turns out is also based in the same small, as you mentioned, in this, it's from the same hometown as the Interior Secretary. So this has raised some questions to begin with. Additionally, it's just that lack of procedure that wasn't followed. So there wasn't an open bidding process in the lead up to it. So all of these questions have been coming up over the past week.
Well, there are also clauses in this contract that said the profits of Whitefish could not be audited by the government at all. And Nitti, Maggie Kurth-Baker of 538 was on the show last week, and she said there's a long history of shady contracts and potential corruption at PREPA. That looks like it started to catch up with the Puerto Rican government.
That's right. This has been a troubled authority for a long time. And I think another thing to keep in mind here is that it was deeply in debt when the storm hit. It was several billion dollars in debt to begin with. One of the justifications that the head of the power authority has given for entering into these contracts is that those usual mutual aid agreements require some guarantee of payment, and that Whitefish, he says, didn't ask for that guarantee.
So, Nitti Prakash, we're going to keep following this story. What does Puerto Rico still need since you've just returned?
So, you know, I think, to be honest with you, Todd, the most urgent, pressing thing is water. Water and power. And obviously, you know, people are being given estimates of 6 to 7 months before the power is restored in many parts of Puerto Rico. I think without that baseline, it's going to be a long road to recovery.
Nitti Prakash with BuzzFeed, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Todd.
You know, when there's no power for internet and television, your town is cut off, how do you get your news? Well, you're listening to it right now. After Hurricane Maria, when the call went out for engineers to go to Puerto Rico to help get a local radio station, WIPR, back on the air, two of our own at WNYC responded. They were equipped with an emergency radio kit designed for tsunamis that they got from Alaska Public Radio, and those engineers headed to tropical Puerto Rico, unsure of what they would find. Denny Roganot is engineering manager for New York Public Radio and WNYC for our team here. He made the trip alongside engineer Peter Polanco, and Roganot says when they arrived and turned the dial in the car to the station they were supposed to be fixing, there was the worst sound you can have in this business: silence.
The station was off the air, and they've been off the air since Hurricane Maria, which was about a month prior to our arrival there.
So that must have killed you, Danny. I mean, flipping on the frequency and hearing nothing is an excruciating sound for a radio man.
Oh, absolutely. We go berserk here when we're off the air for 3 seconds. So I can imagine over a month of being off the air for them was very bad.
Yeah, well, you're there to help, and so you've got this tsunami radio kit. What kind of gear are we talking about when you open up all your cases and get to work? What are you working with?
Well, it's three boxes, Todd, of a radio to-go kit. One box contained a studio, which is audio gear to play audio sources. The other box was a transmitter, and there was another bag, a long bag, with an antenna, a portable antenna, that extends up to 20 feet long.
So I know this is all in a day's work for you, not necessarily magic or anything like that, a lot of skill and a lot of engineering. But talk about the moment when you got power into this antenna, when it's up and running, and WIPR was back on the air.
Well, it was a moment to celebrate. We were very happy that the station came back on the air. It wasn't easy. We ran into some problems with the equipment that was delivered. We had an issue with condensation, internal condensation in the amplifier. So we had some issues getting the transmitter back on. But when the transmitter came back on the air, the workers there at the station rejoiced. We took a drive around the area just to listen to the signal inside of the car radio. And the station played out. We received a signal approximately 20 miles radius in the San Juan area after the transmitter was powered up.
Wow, that's great. What were you listening to?
We were listening to classical music. WIPR in San Juan is a classical format station, similar to our WQXR here in New York. The next day, they changed their format because they were receiving an STL microwave feed from the convention center in San Juan, and the governor was doing a press conference on a daily basis there. So they went outside their classical format and started broadcasting from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m., the governor's conference at the convention center. At these times, radio is one of the most key communication sources. When you're out of power, you can use a battery-powered radio to listen in and get up-to-date information into homes where there's no power.
Well, Danny Roganot, it's an important mission. It was a special mission that you went on, and the fact that you went on it on behalf of all of us in public radio means an awful lot. So thanks for doing it.
Oh, you're welcome. It's not very often us as engineers are given an opportunity to help in a crisis situation. And we were called to duty and we rose to the occasion and we went out and did what we could to help.
Denny Ragonaut is engineering manager at New York Public Radio and one of the many people who keep us on the air and hopefully sounding good through WNYC. Danny, it's a pleasure to have you on the mic.
Thank you, Todd.
White nationalists from across the country converged on the town of Shelbyville in the middle of Tennessee over the weekend, rallying for White Lives Matter and protesting refugees living in the area.
Close borders! Come on! Close borders!
Close borders!
White nation!
Now we start deportation!
Bit of a tepid call and response there from white nationalists in Tennessee. But the group was met by a large police presence and counter-protesters who outnumbered them by at least 2-1. A second rally planned for nearby Murfreesboro in Tennessee got canceled when about 1,000 counter-protesters turned up. Natalie Allison was there. She's a reporter for the Tennessee. And Natalie, welcome.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
There were chants of Nazi slogans at this rally, taunting of minorities and immigrants. You were there. What was the scene like?
There were approximately 200 protesters on the White Lives Matter side. They were coming from groups that were part of Nationalist Front, including the Traditionalist Workers Party, League of the South, the National Socialist Movement, Vanguard America. And if you're familiar with Unite the Right in Charlottesville this August, those were among the groups that were there. And as you mentioned, they were outnumbered, not so much as in Shelbyville as they were in Murfreesboro, where they didn't show up. But in Shelbyville, there were probably more than 300, 400 counter-protesters. There wasn't violence. They all were going through TSA-style security, both sides. But yeah, there was lots of chanting. There was both sides trying to talk over the other via microphones. They were the white nationalist side was chanting things like blood and soil, we will not be replaced, white lives matter, hail Dixie, hail victory. But there wasn't the violence that was seen at Charlottesville.
Why Shelbyville and Murfreesboro, even though Murfreesboro got canceled? What's the backdrop of these demonstrations? What's been going on in these communities?
So when League of the South announced in early October they're holding these rallies, well, they initially only announced Shelbyville. They said it was to protest refugee resettlement in the area and to specifically draw attention to a fatal shooting last month in Antioch, which is right outside of Nashville, where a man entered a church right as the services were letting out that Sunday morning and opened fire. One woman died and six others were shot. This suspect and this killing happened to be a Sudanese immigrant. He came to the United States in 1996, so he was a child then. His name is Emmanuel Sampson. He's 25 years old now. And the White Lives Matter group, specifically League of the South, they felt that the killing wasn't getting the same attention that the Charleston shooting involving Dylann Roof got. They said that because the suspect in this case was a black man and he was an immigrant and not a white man, that for whatever reason, the media was burying the story, which, of course, the media did report on it. Unlike the Charleston shooting, one person was killed versus nine. So that could explain why it didn't receive as much attention.
So part of this demonstration, Natalie, in reaction to this shooting, but the broader context here, we saw Charlottesville, we've now seen Tennessee. Do these types of demonstrations, have they always gone on, but no one really covered them because they were small fringe groups? Or are they growing more prominent? Is this a growing movement?
I can tell you that since I've been a reporter over the past 5 years or so, I didn't see these demonstrations become prominent until after November of 2016. They've always happened, though. I spoke with a woman in Shelbyville when I went a couple weeks before the rally. She was in her mid-60s, but she said she recalled watching the KKK march through town in Shelbyville in 1980. There was a while where it was just accepted as these people would come and they would demonstrate and they would say their part, and many people would be offended or hurt by it, but but people would move on. And now we see these organized counter demonstrations. We see groups like Antifa. We see communities like in Shelbyville and Murfreesboro that created social media accounts and social media campaigns to organize counter protesters. And Murfreesboro came up with an organization just in the past month called Murfreesboro Loves, and they've announced plans to continue holding demonstrations and gatherings long after Saturday was over. So I do think because there's more attention, both from media and from people in the community, that these are becoming a much hotter issue.
White nationalist and neo-Nazi rally in Tennessee met with massive counter-protests. Natalie Allison with the Tennessean, thanks so much.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
This past April, Immigration and Customs Enforcement launched a hotline called the Victims of Immigration Crime Engagement, or VOICE. It was all based on an executive order signed by President Trump back in January. And the mission here, according to ICE, is to, quote, support victims of crimes committed by criminal aliens. But call logs and internal training records tell a different story. Daniel Rivero is an investigative reporter for Fusion's The Naked Truth, and he obtained some of those records. He says that more often than not, this hotline voice is being used to allow people to report on the presence of undocumented immigrants.
We got training documents from this voice hotline, and we found that the hotline is in fact, quote, provide a means for people to report suspected criminal activity. And we found through the voice logs that we received that people are indeed using it as a crime reporting tool. And ICE is actually using it as somewhat of an intelligence gathering operation. They are getting a lot of reports from people in the public who are reporting all sorts of just day-to-day things. People are reporting their neighbors, their coworkers, places where they eat. So the federal government has really said that they're doing it to help victims, but the way that it's actually being used is quite something different.
So are people using the hotline to report serious crimes that might be perpetrated by an undocumented immigrant, like a robbery or an assault, or are they reporting something different?
So there are legitimate crimes that are reported through this hotline. There was one case of a woman who I actually spoke to who says that her 11-year-old daughter was raped by her husband, who she said was undocumented. She called the hotline for help to get him removed and into the federal government's custody. But what we found is that the vast majority of people that are actually calling this hotline are calling it on just day-to-day things. Someone that they saw at the gym who they suspect is undocumented, a conversation they overheard with someone that they suspect is undocumented. The majority of people are using it in that way.
Now, you've seen some of the logs, some of the transcripts of conversations on the voice hotline. What are one or two that stand out?
So there was a case of a man who called the ICE hotline because he said that his stepson was parking his car somewhere where he wasn't supposed to be parking it, and that he was a drug addict and he wanted him deported. And what comes up in the log is he says, you know, please, ICE, don't call me on this phone number because I don't want my wife to know that I'm trying to get her son deported. That was, you know, that's a pretty tricky case there. And there was another case of a woman who was calling to report someone who was starting a business who she felt like the business she was starting would compete with her dance studio and she would be taking customers from her. So she called in to report this woman. And there was a lot of cases where people were calling the hotline to report people who were accusing the caller of domestic violence. So it was being used in, I guess I would say, some questionable ways.
And is there any evidence of how ICE is using this information? First of all, have they arrested anyone of a serious crime that was reported on Voice?
So we don't have that level of information here. What we have is the calls that came into the hotline, and in some cases, there are notes about how the federal government responded to them. A lot of people's names are being run through the system. The majority of people, at least for the first couple weeks after it was launched, were not found in ICE's system that keeps track of undocumented immigrants. But we do know in several cases that the operators of the hotline actually contacted ICE field offices to relay some of the information. So there is some amount of information and intelligence sharing going on between the hotline and the officers at the street level.
So there are lots of examples in law enforcement, Daniel, of crime hotlines where people can report crimes. And that's not new. There's an additional aspect here, which is neighbors reporting on neighbors, maybe just for suspicion of being undocumented, or it sounds like at times maybe just for domestic disputes or interpersonal disputes. How do we know how valuable this hotline really is?
You know, ultimately that will be determined in the long term. What we know now is that when the hotline came out, some of the initial pushback against it was that it was duplicating efforts that are already happening at the local level. When you have a domestic abuse case, say, the best person to call is usually your local police department. Now, what the federal government has done now is they've created an additional layer to notify the feds that this happened, even though it might be a case that would typically be handled at the local level, to get them involved if the person who is a suspect of that is suspected to be in the country illegally. The rhetoric on these kind of crimes and immigration in general has really been amped up over the last couple months with the Trump administration. And what we see through the logs is that people are responding to that very much. They're using the suspected, you know, immigration status of people to call the authorities on their neighbors. We don't know the long-term effect of that, but we know now that people are very much using it in that way to kind of inform on people in their communities.
Daniel, what did ICE say about this story when you contacted them?
When we contacted ICE, we actually told them that some of the information that we found online contained all sorts of personal information about the callers and, in addition to the callers, the alleged victims of these crimes. So we actually found published on ICE's website a spreadsheet that contained addresses, social security numbers, phone numbers, work addresses, work hours. So when we contacted them, ICE actually didn't respond to it. They didn't respond to our queries until a couple hours after our story was published. So since then, ICE has actually asked us in a legal letter to stop reporting on the information that we found on their website, and also to destroy or just get rid of the information that we received, even though it was published on their website by them.
Reporting on the new illegal immigration hotline from the Trump administration, Daniel Rivero, investigative reporter for Fusion's The Naked Truth. Daniel, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
There's another immigration story in Texas pitting the federal government against a minor who needs medical care. Earlier this month, federal authorities refused to allow a 17-year-old undocumented girl access to a legal abortion. Then last week, immigration authorities stopped an ambulance at a checkpoint carrying 10-year-old Rosa Maria Hernandez. She was being taken to a hospital for emergency gallbladder surgery. Officials let Hernandez have the surgery, but then they waited at the hospital and afterward detained her. Hernandez is undocumented, but has lived in the United States since she was 3 months old. Hernandez also has cerebral palsy and is now in a detention center for minors. Julian Aguilar is a border and immigration reporter for the Texas Tribune. Julian, what's the latest in this case?
The latest is that this 10-year-old girl, Rosa Maria, as you mentioned, is in what immigration attorneys and even the federal government refer to as a shelter. But you're correct. For all intents and purposes, it is a detention center because she's obviously not being allowed to leave because of her immigration status. So she was taken there late last week after the surgery. And as far as I know, over the weekend and any updated reports, she is still there and her family is still trying to get her released into the custody of, if not her mother, who is also undocumented, her U.S. citizen cousin, or her grandfather, who's a legal permanent resident.
Now, Julian, lawyers and lawmakers have pointed out that the INS's own guidelines here say that border officials are supposed to avoid places like hospitals and schools for enforcement actions. They're supposed to be off limits. Why did the government choose to go to a hospital where a girl was having surgery and choose that as a place to detain her?
Well, the government, the U.S. Border Patrol, and the Division of Health and Human Services both said that she's being processed as would any other undocumented person. And you're correct, Congressman Joaquin Castro, a Democrat from San Antonio, said that according to Immigration and Customs Enforcement's sensitive areas guidelines, that churches and hospitals are usually not supposed to be areas of enforcement. But even under the Obama administration, ICE has always said that, you know, those are guidelines and those are general instructions that we give our agents, and we would like them to prioritize our resources on bad people. But I think this is just another symbol that the Trump administration is taking no prisoners. In this case, it's extremely rare, but I think they're sending a message that if you're here without papers, then you're subject to the laws of the land.
Well, we saw this case that we've been talking about over the last few weeks, the 17-year-old girl Jane Doe seeking an abortion in Texas, who was not allowed to have that procedure until the court ordered it. Are these cases, as you say, are an indication of stepped up enforcement? Is there a new federal strategy playing out in Texas here?
I wouldn't know if it's a new federal strategy or any guidelines that were sent out other than the January 25th memo from the Trump administration saying we're going to crack down on illegal immigration. I mean, this is something that's been happening. You hear about people, you know, DACA recipients detained at Border Patrol checkpoints, and whether that's to scare them or to send the message, that's been happening in Texas as well. When Austin, Texas made national headlines for being a quote unquote sanctuary jurisdiction, you saw ICE raids immediately thereafter where they netted dozens on their way to work or after being pulled over for traffic violations. And these are folks that under the Obama administration would have probably been released or not considered a high priority. So I think it's indiscriminate enforcement, and it's under the purview of the Trump administration's own guidelines to determine why. But again, you know, the federal government says if you're here unlawfully, then you're subject to removal proceedings. And I don't think that they are prioritizing. I just think they're going after whomever they can get. And maybe they're going after people that are easier to get, you know, people that don't have criminal records or people that, you know, they just come into contact with during a traffic stop or in the case of Rosa Maria, a Border Patrol checkpoint, because they're actually going to immigration officials instead of immigration officials having to look for them. So, you know, everybody's a target here. If you're here illegally, obviously DACA is going to end soon. So that sends another sign. And I think this is just another example, albeit a very sensitive and controversial one when it deals with a 10-year-old girl with cerebral palsy. But this is just another message, I think, that the Trump administration is doing what it said it's going to do.
Julian Aguilar with the Texas Tribune, thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome back, and thanks for being with us today on The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Last week, as historians and enthusiasts were poring over those newly released documents on the JFK assassination, another set of government documents from the 1960s came out. They reveal a lot about the United States' role in a violent coup and the slaughter of hundreds of thousands of people in Indonesia. The documents are a series of U.S. diplomatic cables from 1964 to 1968. It's a daily record of the U.S. Embassy in Indonesia during those years. The U.S. at the time backed General Suharto, and after a power struggle, Suharto became president in Indonesia. And what followed was a massive anti-communist purge that may have killed a million people. Now, for the first time, these new documents publicly reveal what the U.S. knew and the extent of America's complicity in Suharto's mass killings in Indonesia. Brad Simpson is a historian at the University of Connecticut. He's also the director of the Indonesia Documentation Project at the National Security Archive. Brad, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
So, Brad, this all takes place in the backdrop of the Cold War. Suharto seizes power. There's a massive anti-communist purge that extends far beyond actual communists in the government or the military. What do these documents say about what exactly the United States knew and what it did to help?
Well, what these documents show is that American officials were aware from the start, as the army began this campaign of mass murder, that the people who were being killed were utterly innocent of involvement or even knowledge of the September 30th movement, and that their only crime was to be members or supporters of a legal political party or members of the left more generally in Indonesia. They also show that U.S. officials were aware from days after the September 30th movement failed that the army was beginning to carry out mass executions and mass killings of unarmed civilians, and that it in fact was enthusiastically supportive of these killings because American officials believed that the army had to take advantage of this moment of opportunity, this moment of crisis, and strike decisively to break the back of and annihilate the Indonesian Communist Party, lest it miss an opportunity that might never return. And the details in some of these cables are truly horrifying. They reveal that Indonesian army officials and their paramilitary allies were slaughtering hundreds of people every night in Central and East Java. They reveal that some of the Muslim militias that the Indonesian army aligned itself with in order to carry out these killings were executing people en masse because they didn't want to feed or house them because they're arresting so many people that they didn't know what to do with them. Later, after the killings had ceased, The U.S. National Security Advisor McGeorge Bundy commented to Lyndon Johnson that our policy was silence.
That's the Johnson administration. And Brad, you wrote a book on this topic called Economists with Guns, and there's a long history here. Classified documents from later, from 1975, 10 years later, also revealed that President Gerald Ford and Henry Kissinger personally gave Suharto the green light to invade East Timor in December of 1975 using U.S. weapons. Kissinger denied this for decades, but it is true. These documents that you're talking about today point to U.S. involvement much, much earlier, and really then a long history, a connected history of U.S. involvement in atrocities in Indonesia.
The U.S. history in Indonesia goes back much further. The United States actually played a decisive role in bringing about Indonesian independence in 1949 when it sided with the Republican and Nationalist forces in the later years of the Truman administration. But by the late 1950s, the Eisenhower administration had grown concerned about the peaceful rise of the Indonesian Communist Party and actually helped to sponsor a civil war in Indonesia through a massive U.S. covert operation engaged in by the Central Intelligence Agency that almost ripped the country apart and led to the deaths of thousands of people between 1957 and 1959. Low-level covert operations continued through the early 1960s as the U.S. sought to build up the Indonesian armed forces and police as a sort of counterweight to the mass movements such as the Communist Party that were gaining steam in Indonesia over the course of the 1960s. And by 1965, U.S. officials had largely concluded that the mass movements of the left were a strategic threat to U.S. interests in the region and had to be eliminated, and that U.S. interests could best be served by an authoritarian government run by Western-trained and Western-oriented technocrats that would both keep the left in check as well as serve the interests of Western corporations and Western governments in the region.
So, Brad, when you look at Indonesia now in the context of all of this grim history, the world's largest Muslim country, relatively moderate, and an ally of the United States, how does that fit with the history? And could some extremely real politician point to this history and say, as awful as it was, it worked. Indonesia's stable now.
Well, many American officials claim that the destruction of the left helped to rescue the country from potential communist dictatorship. But what really happened is that the destruction of the Indonesian Communist Party, which was a party of ordinary Indonesians, you know, millions of them, led the country into decades of military dictatorship, of human rights abuses, of genocide in East Timor, and of the progressive destruction of Indonesian civil society, a dictatorship that delayed the emergence of real democracy in Indonesia by more than three decades until Suharto was finally overthrown by mass movements in 1998. Today, we see a resurgence in attempts by the armed forces and conservative Muslim organizations to once again wave the banner of anti-communism as a way of attacking those who are pressing for greater human rights and greater democratization in Indonesia. These groups have attacked the current Indonesian president, Jokowi, as being descended from communists, a sort of political blood libel in the Indonesian context. They have attacked human rights organizations and advocates for gay and lesbian rights as being neo-communists. And they have attacked those who are demanding a public accountability and a sort of public truth-telling of the events of 1965 as trying to stir up the pot, and activists and survivors groups who have attempted to engage in simply discussions about these events have been attacked by mobs and rented thugs in an attempt to try and prevent any sort of meaningful discussion of these events. What I think these documents show is the extraordinary danger of abandoning human rights in the name of anti-communism or any other ideology that supposedly serves American interests. In the name of anti-communism, the United States supported the slaughter of hundreds of thousands of people in Indonesia in 1965 and led to decades of military dictatorship. And now we see the presidency of Donald Trump once again embracing authoritarian governments such as President Duterte in the Philippines, as well as many other places, that are slaughtering their own citizens in the name of the war on drugs, in the name of counterterrorism, and signaling matters. In 1965, the signal sent by the United States let the Indonesian army know that they could slaughter its own citizens with impunity. And the signals being sent by the Trump administration today signal to rights-abusing regimes around the world that they can torture and murder their own citizens without having to worry about any negative consequences from the United States. And I think that this is truly a dangerous moment for human rights around the world, not just in Indonesia.
Brad Simpson, director of the Indonesia Documentation Project at the National Security Archive. Brad, it's been great having you.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Well, we are still following the big story of the day. Former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort indicted on 12 mostly financial-related charges, including conspiracy against the United States. Now, of course, charges don't mean guilty in America, but no matter what happens to Paul Manafort and Rick Gates, as we said, the political ramifications are still to come, and Washington is now in full scandal mode. We're going to be following the indictments and the political fallout. We want your take all along. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway and join the conversation, as always, on our Facebook page. Thanks so much for listening on this big news, very busy Monday. It's been great having you with us. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.